I had a friend growing up whose nickname was Smoke. It had nothing to do with smoking. The guy didn't touch the stuff. But after a few years of calling him that, I couldn't really say why we called him Smoke, where the nickname came from exactly, even though I was certain that I was there the first time we started calling him that. And that's because Smoke's just a great nickname, with the potential for a lot of different origin stories. And so we had a few theories about where it came from. Just take basketball, which we played a whole lot of back then. You can smoke somebody or get smoked, meaning to beat somebody soundly, to trounce them. Or you can smoke the nets for three or catch fire and be smoking from beyond the arc. And Smoke could play, he could shoot, no doubt. So sometimes we'd say that that was the origin story. But we all knew that there was more to it than that, that where there's smoke, there's fire, if you will. At any rate, I figured that something makes for a great nickname would also make for a good source of idioms. So welcome to episode 9 of this season's Idiom America, where we'll take a look at some idioms having to do with smoke or smoking. And one of my favorites is when you get to tell somebody to put that in your pipe and smoke it. Also sometimes heard as stick that in your pipe and smoke it. And I'm pretty sure that I said this to Smoke a time or two, as we did like to argue about stuff. And this is a juicy phrase to playfully lay down after you've just refuted somebody's argument. Kind of like, how do you like them apples? More generally, it's just a way of saying take that or think about that after a verbal pronouncement that expresses finality of some sort, or kind of a rude way to emphasize to someone that they must accept a situation or outcome even if they don't like it or agree with it. Like, oh yeah, well, I happen to think that this is the best route to take, so put that in your pipe and smoke it. And this one's been around since the mid-1800s, and although it's not entirely clear where it comes from, it seems natural to me that it would have something to do with the idea that pipe smoking and thoughtful pondering of events while you're smoking your pipe seem to go together. A more diplomatic way to end an argument than by telling somebody to stick it in their pipe and smoke it would be to smoke the peace pipe together with somebody, meaning to stop arguing and fighting. And that, of course, comes from the ceremonial pipe that would be smoked by some Native American tribes as a way to memorialize the resolution of a dispute or the cessation of fighting. And, of course, tobacco is not the only thing known to have been smoked from a pipe. And some substances don't lend themselves nearly so well to thoughtful pondering of events. Take opium, for example, which gave rise to the idiom pipe dream. And pipe dream means a plan, desire, or idea that will likely not work. A near impossibility, improbable fantasy, pie in the sky, castle in the air kind of stuff. And this is an allusion to the dreams that are experienced by the smokers of opium pipes. And somewhat surprisingly, considering the long history of opium smoking, the idiom pipe dream appears to have originated in Chicago at the end of the 1800s, as it starts popping up there in newspapers and plays, et cetera, some of which specifically refer to its origins in the opium den. And a variation of this one that you hear today is when somebody asks you what you've been smoking, when they think that some idea is wacky or far out, hard to believe. Here's something I learned when I was looking into these smoke idioms, and that's that doctors used to literally blow smoke up people's rectums. A tobacco smoke enema used to be a general mainstream medical procedure that doctors used to, among other things, try to resuscitate people who were otherwise presumed dead. And it was particularly common as a resuscitation method for drowning victims. The smoke was thought to warm the victim and dry out the person's insides, removing excessive moisture, with the nicotine stimulating the heart to beat stronger and faster. So if you had a drowning victim, they'd insert a tube that was connected to a bellows that they'd pump to force smoke into the rectum. And this was so common that this equipment was hung alongside major waterways so that your good citizen rescuer would be prepared. Kind of like the defibrillators you see hanging about in office buildings these days. And of course, if a tube and bellows wasn't available, they'd use whatever was handy, such as a smoking pipe. And this began in the mid-1700s, and it reached its peak in the early 19th century, before nicotine was discovered to be toxic to the cardiac system, and the practice generally declined in popularity over the next several decades. But even though literally blowing smoke up someone's ass gradually became a thing of the past, idiomatically the practice is alive and well. Blowing smoke up someone's ass means, of course, to compliment somebody, usually insincerely, in order to inflate their ego, as in, I mean it, man, I'm not just blowing smoke up your ass. And I never really liked hearing this one because it evoked for me an unpleasant image, and it's kind of vulgar, but now that I can replace that image with one of a tube and bellows and drowning victims, it's a bit better, perhaps, a bit more comedy to it, anyway. And these tobacco smoke enemas aren't the only harmful medical practice that used to be commonplace that we now shake our heads at today. Think about bloodletting, where you take out small quantities of blood from a patient to cure or prevent illness, which was probably the most common medical procedure for about 2,000 years. Or take trepanning, which involved boring a small hole into the skull to expose the dura mater, the outer membrane of the brain. And this was done to supposedly alleviate pressure and treat health problems thought to be in the head. And it was used to try to cure epilepsy, migraines, and mental disorders, and even as a fix for physical problems like skull fractures. And needless to say, exposing the brain to airborne germs was not a very good idea, and this would often result in infection and death. Which reminds me of kind of the quasi-idiom, I need that like I need another hole in the head, to refer to something unwanted. But blowing smoke, in general, has a broader idiomatic use with a few different meanings, such as to make plans without an intention to follow through, kind of like the waitresses in Casey Musgrave's song, Blowing Smoke. Or it can mean to try to deceive others, particularly in the sense of trying to impress others by making up stories about yourself, telling tall tales, trying to make yourself seem more important than you really are, exaggerate or boast about yourself. He says he's played with Bruce Springsteen, but I think he's just blowing smoke. And it could also mean to cover up some kind of trick, to cheat somebody and try to look innocent, or to misdirect. She says she's only here for the cookies, but I think she's blowing smoke. The origin of this idiom seems to come from the way that old magicians would release a puff of smoke to conceal some little trick behind their magic, and it's been used since the early 1900s. On a related note, smoke and mirrors is another smoke idiom that seems to have come from the practices of magicians. And this idiom, of course, refers to misleading or irrelevant information that's used to obscure or embellish the truth. It's also used to refer to something that lacks substance, so calling some politician's argument smoke and mirrors implies that it may seem good, but that it's not real or effective. And there's a famous magical illusion that uses smoke and mirrors to make an entity appear to hover in empty space, and it relies on a hidden projector, which back in the day was known as a magic lantern, and the beam of that would reflect off a mirror into a cloud of smoke, which would scatter the beam to create an image. I'll put a picture up of one of these devices up on the website if you want to take a look. It was documented as early as 1770, and it spread widely after its use by the charlatan Johann Georg Schröpfer, who claimed the apparitions in that smoke to be conjured spirits. And after that, it became a fixture of 19th century phantasmagoria shows. And if you're not familiar with that particular genre, phantasmagoria, it was a form of horror theater that used magic lanterns to project frightening images like skeletons, demons, and ghosts onto walls, smoke, or semi-transparent screens, typically using rear projection or mirrors to keep the lantern out of sight. And in many shows, they used spooky decorations, total darkness, suggestive verbal presentation, and sound effects as well. And some shows even added in other sensory stimulation like smells and electric shocks. And then you even had elements like fasting being required or being fatigued from late night shows and drugs as methods of making sure that the spectators would be really convinced of what they saw. And with such a storied history, you'd think the idiom smoke and mirrors would have been around for centuries, but surprisingly, it seems that the earliest use of this idiom came from a biography about the Watergate political scandal that was written by the American political journalist James Breslin and published in 1975. And he used this smoke and mirrors imagery twice to describe political power. All political power is primarily an illusion. Mirrors and blue smoke, beautiful blue smoke rolling over the surface of highly polished mirrors. If somebody tells you how to look, there can be seen in the smoke great magnificent shapes, castles and kingdoms, and maybe they can be yours. And again, the ability to create the illusion of power to use mirrors and blue smoke is one found in unusual people. And so although we didn't use the term smoke and mirrors verbatim, others followed his lead and picked up on it, and the phrase entered the lexicon pretty quickly after that, to the point where it's now commonly used to refer to anything that, when you examine it closely, turns out to be an illusion. And a related term here, maybe not quite an idiom, is smokescreen, something that you do or say to hide the truth about your true intentions or actions. For example, in American politics, ideology is often a smokescreen for individual ambition. And literally, this one means a dense cloud of smoke that a military uses to conceal its positions, movements, or operations. And it can be deployed by a canister, like a smoke grenade or smoke shell, or it can be generated by a vehicle that has a smoke generator mounted on it, like a tank or a warship. And history is replete with examples of the use of these smoke screens, like the Red Army laying out a smoke screen that was almost 20 miles long for the crossing of the Dnieper River back in October 1943, or the Confederate Navy's R.E. Lee using a smoke screen during the American Civil War to run a blockade and escape the USS Iroquois. But its use probably goes back longer than that, as long as incendiary weapons have been used at sea, such as Greek fire, stink pots, fire ships, and incendiaries on the decks of turtle ships. Because where there's fire, there's also bound to be smoke, I guess. And that, of course, is the reverse of the idiom or proverb, more properly probably, where there's smoke, there's fire. Meaning that when there's some indication of a problem or wrongdoing, such a thing probably occurred or exists. That if something looks wrong, there's probably something wrong there. And this one likely goes back for millennia. It appears in John Haywood's 1546 Proverbs, and it's a proverb in a lot of different languages like German, Italian, Spanish, etc. And you frequently hear this one with respect to law enforcement investigations in situations where there's all the outward signs that something criminal's afoot, but there's no hard evidence just yet. Or to put it another way, there's no smoking gun yet. And a smoking gun, of course, is a piece of evidence that is irrefutably true, a fact or thing that proves conclusively that a crime has occurred or that someone is guilty. And the term arose from a time where smoke coming from a gun meant the gun was recently shot. Think of those old black powder muskets. So if someone's gun was smoking, that would be considered strong evidence of their shooting at something recently. And a notable use of this one in the form smoking pistol occurs in the 1893 Sherlock Holmes story, The Adventure of the Gloria Scott. But this is another smoke idiom that really got popular due to the Watergate investigation during the 1970s, where there was a particular White House tape recording dubbed the Smoking Gun Tape. And in the recording, Nixon tells Haldeman to order the CIA and FBI to stop investigating the Watergate break-in under the pretext of protecting national security. And at the Watergate congressional hearing, Representative Barbara Connable said the new evidence looked like a smoking gun. But it's now evolved beyond referring to the kind of circumstantial strong evidence in the criminal or legal context or refer to any kind of strong evidence, like scientific evidence that is highly suggestive in favor of a particular hypothesis, can be called smoking gun evidence. Well, holy smokes, that's another episode in the books. But first, let's look at that one quickly, which you also hear in the singular is holy smoke. And it's used to say that one is very surprised, pleased, or excited, as in, I look at some of the new technology they're coming out with today, and I think, holy smoke, what will the world think of next? And I thought this one might have something to do with the burning of ballots that they use to elect a pope. That smoke that comes out of the Sistine Chapel, the black smoke to signify there's been no decision, or the white smoke to signify that a new pope's been chosen. That's probably the holiest smoke I can think of, but there doesn't seem to be any connection there. It might have something to do with another kind of holy smoke, that which comes from the burning of incense, as the earliest recorded use of this term is from a 1627 poem that alludes to the burning of religious incense, and this continues all the way up to a Rudyard Kipling poem in 1892. And the term seemed to get fairly popular in American poetry in the 1890s, which is also when it started to get used as an idiom, too, as kind of a mock religious exclamation and mild oath on the model of the older Holy Moses from the 1850s, or Holy Terror and Holy Joe from the 1880s. And then later you get things like Holy Cow, Holy Toledo, Holy Moly, last episode, Holy Guacamole. With the popularity of these mild curses of surprise changing over time. Nowadays, you can think of a more vulgar version of holy crap that seems to be perhaps the most popular. And holy smokes is still fairly popular, but it probably reached the height of its popularity in the 50s and 1950s and 60s when you had TV shows like Batman with Robin, who would exclaim, "Holy smoke, Batman." And there's, of course, more smoke idioms, like to smoke somebody out, for things to go up in smoke. You could call somebody smoking, smoke signals, smoke-filled rooms, or smoke like a chimney. But that'll do until next time, as this episode is about to vanish in a puff of smoke.